Here at The Guardian, we love podcasts. Not only do we make dozens of award winners ourselves, but we also write about our favourite podcasts from around the world too. Every week, our column Hear Hear, that's here as in hearing and here as in where, comes out filled with recommendations from you, our listeners. We sift through them all to find the hidden gems that the podcasting world has to offer. These podcasts are often small yet mighty productions, which you probably wouldn't find highlighted on your usual podcatchers. So, if you're looking for your next podcast or have one that you want to share with the world, sign up for our weekly Hear Hear newsletter at theguardian.com/podmail and send us an email at podcasts@theguardian.com.
Hello and welcome to the Books Podcast with me, Claire Armistead.
And me, Sian Kane.
February is one of the greyest months in the UK, but for the last 14 years, it's been bathed in a rainbow hue by LGBT History Month. 4 weeks of events around the country celebrating the lives and work of lesbian, gay, bisexual and trans people. This year's theme is geography, mapping the world. Later in the programme, we'll be talking to Christine Burns, a veteran trans activist, about her invaluable new anthology of writing, charting the history, politics and first-hand experience of transgender people, not just here today, but across continents and centuries. But first, Sian and I will be doing some mapping of our own of the LGBT literature that will enrich your life. Sian, I hadn't realised until this week that you had an earlier incarnation as an agenda-setting bookseller.
Yeah, I actually can't believe I didn't tell you about this. So I worked as a bookseller for about 5 years in my life before The Guardian, and I worked for a year in Blackwell's bookshop in Oxford, the best bookshop in the world. And I was there when they decided that they wanted to install a gay and lesbian and transgender fiction area. So I sort of helped curate that, and I did a lot of research and I did a lot of ordering and a lot of reading to set that up, because it is a funny debate about whether you do these things and whether either you're sort of ghettoizing a community or whether you're actually giving them a space to feel free. You know, it's a welcoming thing. You're saying, you know, we recognise you and we're going to make this easier for you to navigate. Because not, you know, books aren't overtly gay, you know, all the time.
Yeah, some books are.
Oh, yeah.
Like, we said before we mentioned this that we're not going to mention The Well of Loneliness.
No, well, yes, I will mention it, but I'll say don't read it. Because books aren't necessarily, you know, overtly going to advertise that they might have a gay romance subplot, for example. So it's actually quite useful for people to know that they can just pick up a regular literary novel and know that they might have some recognition in there. I was speaking to the owner of the bookshop Gaze the Word, which operates in London. I was speaking to him last year, and he was saying that they get visitors, you know, they get teenagers coming down from, you know, North England who have just come down just to go to his shop, and they've given their family some excuse because they're not out yet and they need to sort of explore this world on their own, and so they're doing it through literature. So it can be really useful to have a reading list of things to go read.
And what books did you put in it, and how many books did you put in it?
Well, it was sort of what you'd call a bay. So it was one bay, and we put it just next to general fiction section. We had a translated fiction section as well. So we did a lot of dividing, but I filled it, and we sort of expanded a little bit later. We sort of put some books up because being Blackwell's, we had a whole gender study section downstairs. So we put a little bit of that upstairs too, and then we sort of developed a little nonfiction shelf, and then we did a little thing for anthologies because there is quite a lot of anthology works out there for particularly gay and transgender writing as well. So I think I might start with nonfiction, just because I haven't read as much nonfiction as I've read fiction. But there's an author called Randy Shiltz who I absolutely love. He's written one of the best biographies I've ever read, called The Life and Times of Harvey Milk. Harvey Milk being the very famous American politician who was assassinated while he was in office. He was killed for being gay. And this biography was written within about 5 years of Harvey Milk being assassinated. Randy Shiltz was a journalist. He was openly gay, and he actively pursued stories that involved the gay community in San Francisco. So he started interviewing lots of Harvey Milk's friends and people that knew him from his political work, and wrote this biography, and it's one of the best biographies I've ever read. There's some chapters that have just stayed with me ever since I read them. He also wrote another book called And the Band Played On, which is a history of AIDS, which is also absolutely fascinating. Reads like a novel. It's bad to say, it almost reads like a thriller, but he it's basically documents from the start to the end, because he himself died from AIDS in the 90s. And yeah, it's an absolutely remarkable book as well. There's another great history of AIDS as well, which was written by David France. It won a bunch of prizes last year, called How to Survive a Plague. It was shortlisted for the Wellcome Book Prize, and it also won the Green Carnation Prize for gay writing. That's absolutely fantastic. There's also, in terms of transgender literature, talking about fiction and non-fiction, it is still a field that is dominated by cisgender writers, so people who identify with the gender that they were born with, that were assigned at birth. But there are books like The Gender Games by Juno Dawson, which is a really funny and accessible and almost comedic look at what life is like. It's very lighthearted. It's also, you know, covers some really serious issues, particularly there's some great writing about how she feels fetishized, how she often ends up dating footballers that aren't completely sort of out about their attraction to transgender women. And this is the same for fiction as well. There's actually a lot of writing that involves characters who are transgender that are written by cisgender authors. An exception to that is there's a book called George by Alex Gino, which is for middle schoolers. And a lot of the best writing in both gay and transgender writing at the moment, they're actually for young adults. It's quite amazing just how innovative that field is. Got people like David Levithan, who writes amazing fiction about usually gay teenagers. You also have people like Lisa Williamson, who wrote a book called The Art of Being Normal, which is kind of regarded as a modern classic. She is a cisgender writer, but it's about a transgender girl. It's really, really good. There's also The Miseducation of Cameron Post, which is fantastic, and that's being made into a film this year. She's getting really, really good reviews. It's just premiered, I think, at Sundance. So everyone should read that before the movie comes out. That's the rule. And there's also Rainbow Rowell, who's a really, really good YA author. And she wrote a book called Carry On. And basically the best way to summarize it is Hogwarts with gay wizards. It's so good. It's so much fun. I really, really love it.
So millennial as well.
In terms of like the adult side of things, I mean, you've got sort of the classics. And we mentioned The World of Loneliness before. Now, a lot of people, myself included, have problems with The Well of Loneliness in that it was written in a time, and you can't really fault this, but it was written in a time when, in order to write about gay people and gay love, you often had to punish them in some way in the storyline. And that's the case in The Well of Loneliness. It's really depressing. Like, it makes being a lesbian look like the absolute most miserable thing ever, which it probably was for people at the time. But it's really, I think, when you've got the selection of modern writing now, I don't think you really have to go back and read The Well of Loneliness. And it's really long as well, so.
But there are all these, a whole lot of modern classics. I was absolutely astonished to find that it was 30 years ago that Alan Hollinghurst, yes, made his novel writing debut with Swimming Pool Library. 30 years.
Yeah, and I love Alan Hollinghurst. And I think what he does so well is to look at intergenerational attitudes towards homosexuality. So often his books will feature younger characters and older characters sort of navigating their sexuality in a public and private spheres in very different ways and exploring the attitudes between them. So the envy an older man might feel towards a younger man who can live his life more openly than him. And David Levitt also does this too. There's a particular book that I love called The Lost Language of Cranes. It's about a family. There's two parents and their adult son, and the father is in the closet. He's gay himself, but married a woman, had this son, and his son is gay. And his son is able to live this life openly. He dates men. He sometimes is quite promiscuous. He does basically what he wants, whereas his father has to go to a local gay cinema to sort of meet men and do this sort of all on the sly, and sort of watches his son live the life that he would desperately like to live publicly but can't. Really, really good book. And you've also got people like Armistead Maupin, who's a lot of fun and, again, sort of has been writing for years but has always written really charming, optimistic, happy depictions of gay life. It's never really been the thing that he has to punish them for their lifestyles. And the classic example as well is Maurice by E.M. Forster, which wasn't published until after he died, and he left a really beautiful letter. I suggest everyone listening go read this letter that he wrote about why he recognised that it couldn't be published in his lifetime. But it's a happy ending, and it's kind of unimaginable when you think about when it was written. It's kind of amazing.
And then another big anniversary is the Sarah Waters, the beginning of Sarah Waters 20 years ago, Tipping the Velvet.
Yeah, that's amazing. And I mean, people like Sarah Waters and also Jeanette Winterson, you know, such amazing writers of queer and lesbian characters, you know, it's really lovely, particularly Sarah Waters, just how mainstream she is. She's very widely read. It's not like she's ever been, I think, categorized as something that straight people don't want to read, you know. She's amazing.
Well, they're sort of ripping yarns, really.
Yeah,
aren't they?
Yeah. I mean, a lot of this, I mean, you sort of think about, apart from like maybe Philip Roth, there's not really that many writers out there that sort of go into explicitly being heterosexual, you know? And this idea that any book with a gay plot in it is going to be explicitly gay or overtly gay and only about being gay is kind of ridiculous. I mean, you think about things like Days Without End by Sebastian Barry, which won the Costa last year and was longlisted for the Booker, just how widely read that book was.
And that's so clever, that in that particular book, it just drops in the trans
absolutely
stuff without, it doesn't make a song and dance about it. It doesn't make any song and dance about sex. It just is. It just is.
And I think that's so powerful. And I think that's part of making these books more widely read is just absolutely doing it with confidence and writing these things and having them be incidental. I mean, I absolutely get why particularly gay authors and transgender authors would be attracted to writing very prominently gay and transgender plots, because it's about recognition. It's about demanding a voice. But I mean, there's so many great examples where these romances and these looks at a lifestyle are really incidental. And things like Christos Tolkis, who has always written sort of gay subplots in some of his books, but there's things like Barracuda, which was his most recent book, where it's kind of incidental. I mean,
it's about sport, sporting teenager,
yeah,
in a way, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah. And it sort of goes into the fact that he's got a male partner when he's a bit older, and there is a whole thing about gay dads. I won't say the term that he uses to refer to men who have children who are also gay. But it's far way more about the psychology of being a sportsman, and it's such a great book.
Well, if you can remember half of the books, even half of the books Sian's mentioned, you're going to have a very happy reading year ahead of you, or several years. 2 years ago, I was editing a collection of Guardian journalism, and my publisher questioned whether I should include any pieces about the transgender debate on the grounds that it was so last year, by which he meant that we'd carried a couple of pieces on it in the 2015 edition, and maybe it was time to move on. I had a visceral sense that she was wrong, that this is one of the most important, interesting, and in some quarters, of course, contentious issues facing our culture and our society, as indeed it has proved, with a swelling tide of memoirs and an increasingly acrimonious standoff between feminists and the trans community. But where is the history to anchor all these strong opinions? It's between the pages of a new book, crowdfunded by more than 500 donors. And its editor is Christine Burns, a veteran campaigner for transgender rights, who has assembled more than 20 writers to address everything you ever wanted to know but didn't dare ask. When Christine came into the studio, I began by asking how the idea first came about.
Well, it came about because I'm friends with somebody who used to be the literary editor at The Independent on Sunday. And she said to me, look, I'm going to join this new company, this new publisher. Have you got a book you want to put to me? And I'd already written a couple of self-published books about a particular aspect of trans history. So I said to her, well, I'll go away and have a think. And I sat down and I started sketching ideas. And then I'd always thought with what I'd done before that there was a so much bigger story to be told. And it came along at a time at the end of 2016 when people were starting to say in the press, television, oh, it's all a fad, isn't it? Because suddenly trans people had suddenly been popping up everywhere. And of course, that's a ridiculous idea. But because nobody's ever written this history before, you can understand people for thinking that.
But it's interesting that you have chosen to write this history by calling in lots of people's different experience. So you haven't set out to write the definitive trans history yourself.
No, because I think that's very difficult to do. I first got involved with trans stuff in the 1960s as a teenager. I remember discovering there was a word for what I am on my knees in the kitchen, my parents' pub, reading the News of the World, and I was reading about April Ashley, and it was not a good way to discover what you are. So, and through the 70s, there was practically nothing to find out from. I think it was 1974 that Jan Morris's book came out, pounced on that.
That was Conundrum.
Conundrum, yes. And that was the first time anybody had written an autobiography. And that was, I think, written for the perceptions of what the audience really wanted at that time. So there's not been much over the years, and people have had to find out what they can find out the hard way. I mean, I discovered that there were other people I could meet by ringing up the Samaritans, fairly drunk, and saying, help. And in those days, they used to have a filing cabinet full of addresses, and they said, oh, call these people. And I remember it was an old Victorian house in a place, and this kills it. In Camp Street in Salford, in Manchester. I was a student in Manchester in the early 1970s, and I went to this place on the Wednesday evening, and I sat in my car across the road, staking it out just like I was on a spy assignment, and I saw people coming and going in, and I thought, it's an enormous step to go and knock on the door and say, is this where the trans people meet? And was admitted inside, and I met these other people, and there were springs coming out of the settee, and the coffee cups were cracked, and it wasn't high quality stuff, really. I was so scared at that time, and that was 1975, that I ran away. I gave up my PhD and I thought if I go away and make a new life for myself in industry, I can perhaps forget all this stuff and pretend, let's make another fresh start. Of course, that never works.
I want to bring you back to absolutely to square one, to these to terminology, because you have there's a bit of debate about trans, transgender, transsexual.
Yes.
What is the vocabulary? The
language has evolved over the years. When I first, in those times I'm describing in the 1970s, there were really two words. People were transvestites, which are people who just episodically dress up for the pleasure of it, for an evening. And in every other respects, they're heterosexual men, but they just have that liking for doing that. And then there were transsexual people who were a world apart, people like me, who really feel inside that we are the gender opposite to the one that we were born as. And that was the vocabulary that was with us until right up until the second half of the 1990s. And in one of my other books, I dug out the correspondence where we actually discussed what terminology to use, because as a political activist organisation, we had to think really, really hard about language and what it meant. And we know that being called transsexuals contributed towards being exoticised, seeing the sexual bit, was a big flashing alarm bell. And we wanted, again, to make a fresh start with the language. So we conferred with our associates across the pond in America, and people were starting just to strip it right down to the word trans. And the rationale there in 1997 at the time was that whereas people can treat transsexual as a noun or an adverb or an adjective, all sorts of things, it was as problematic as somebody saying that that's a black. And people of colour hate that because it reduces everything that they are to a noun, which is about their colour. And we felt the same way. And we felt that if we introduced trans to the language, it's extremely difficult to use that as a noun. In fact, it's extremely difficult to use it as anything other than an adjective. And we could play games with that. And we had discussions, how on earth are we going to do this? Because people are immensely stubborn. And we said, well, the only way we're going to do this, we're not going to tell people we're going to do it. We're just going to introduce it to the language. And I was writing most of the content for, in those days, the activist website, Press for Change. That was our campaign for the Gender Recognition Act. And I just started flinging the word in, and my colleagues did, and we were consistent. we got to 2002 with the government. We were trying to persuade them in their initial policy documents for what became the Gender Recognition and Bill. We said, can you use trans? And they said, well, we don't think it's commonly enough understood at the moment. We're going to use transsexual. So we had to live with that. But it was really gratifying as time went by to actually have people start to use it, because it's such an easy term to use. And also it can be used as such a big umbrella. It had no baggage as terminology. So it was what you said it was. And the case law for introducing the Gender Recognition Bill and all the other protections for trans people.
Which you did by stealth as well,
we
didn't
did
you?
Yes. Well, stealth to the extent that we used the European Court of Human Rights and the European Court of Justice.
In order not to have to get it through the courts in this country?
No, in fact, to get to the European Court of Human Rights, you have to have exhausted all the courts in your own country. But it was one of these things that nobody in this country wanted to deal with. They all said, pass it up and pass it up. And it took us, we had four goes getting through the European Court of Human Rights. The first was my colleague Mark Rees in 1986, and he lost his case, and it had taken him 7 or 8 years to get to that point. But at least he actually had people talking about the issues that he'd raised. And that was very important to us, because by taking our case to court, we had a place that was not hysterical, and which actually could just deal with the facts. And no disrespect to your profession in journalism, but that wasn't happening for us. We were having no way of actually being heard. So to actually have those things discussed in court, and then to have people like Claire Dyer, legal correspondent at The Guardian at the time, talking about what had happened, that was really important to us. But say we lost that. And then about 3 years later, another case, almost identical, was Caroline Cossey, who was a television hostess and a model, very like Paris Lees these days. And she took an identical case to the European Court of Human Rights. She lost as well, but actually by a considerably smaller margin. And then another couple of trans women, they went to the European Court of Human Rights in 1997-98. And if one judge had decided to vote the other way, we would have won at that time. But in a way, it was good for us, because we just had a change of government and we needed to lay the ground for what we wanted to happen. It's all about taking this very slowly and tactically and not rushing into things. So that when we finally had the case in 2002 called Goodwin and I versus the UK, and the European Court of Human Rights by this point was totally pissed off with Britain, because they felt, look, you've had 15 years of these cases in which to do something. Nothing's changed. The arguments are exactly the same. In fact, we understand them better. And all the other spurious stuff you're flinging out, really, that's just nonsense. You need to do something. So 17 judges from 17 countries, including the British judge, said unequivocally, Britain, you've got to do something about this.
But winning this legal victory has not actually put paid to the controversy, has it? And there's been a huge amount of transphobia among sort of old lefty feminists, one thing, hasn't there?
Yeah, using exactly the same script they were using when they were young baby feminists in the 1970s. It's exactly the same arguments. That's a depressing thing for people who say that they want a debate, and they've been asking the same questions for 40 years, they've been getting the same answers. The answers haven't suited them, and so they keep asking them. That's not a genuine debate. And if you're going to go into a debate, then you have to accept on both sides, you might actually, have your mind changed on something because you've got more information.
There are two particular issues that come up time and time again, and one is prepubescent children, and the other is trans women in prisons, in women's
women. Let's deal with them in order. Prepubescent children. The sad thing about this is that the discussion in public is so dishonest and so misguided. The truth is that nothing is done to prepubescent children other than to watch them and to give their family support. They're not given any drugs. They're not pushed down any particular road.
They're given hormone.
No, they're not.
Are they not given puberty blocking drugs?
No, puberty blockers are introduced once the first stage of puberty is well underway.
So that's
the child, or now the young person, the adolescent, who is actually of an age where legally they are entitled to have a view on the medical treatment they receive. It's called Gillick competence. It goes right back to, I don't know if you remember Victoria Gillick, on other issues to do with whether doctors could prescribe birth control pills to teenage girls. And when that went all the way up the legal system, that produced the precedent that said, if a child is capable of understanding the issues involved in their treatment, then they are also entitled to actually have a say in it. And by that point, the medical system has already been dealing with that child for years and years. And the key thing about treating anybody who is gender non-conforming, going to this one clinic in the country, is that they have to be insistent and persistent in the face of everything. So you grow up trans, faced with a world which overwhelmingly is telling you you are your natal gender. And this child is still saying, in spite of all the social costs that involves, in my case, I'm a girl, you're wrong. Other children don't do that. People might, play about with dress up, but it's not the same thing. There is nothing like being a trans child. And you actually have to know a trans child in order to actually understand that. There's a chapter in my new book, Trans Britain, where one of the founders of the charity that supports
Mermaids,
that's right, actually tells the story of how Mermaids was created in the early 1990s. I was there to reassure some of those parents at the time, thinking, what's going to happen to my child when they're older? And I was the older trans woman to say, look, here I am. I'm a jet-setting IT consultant. I'm making money. I'm happy. I've got partnerships, and I'm really having a good time. And I'm living the life that I was born to live. And they all sort of, you could feel a collective sigh of relief in the room, and they felt, okay, it's okay now to support my child.
So what about the second issue, prisons?
Prisons, again, this is a debate that's being held on the basis of false information. It's always been the case, although there is a policy that says when somebody has a gender recognition certificate, the prison service will look favourably on accommodating them according to their legal gender. Overriding that is a policy that says the prison service will always accommodate prisoners according to an assessment of safety. So that means that if they had any doubts about a prisoner, then they would put them in accommodation appropriate for the safety of both that prisoner and the rest of the prisoners in the prison estate. And what that means in practice, for instance, is that there are cisgender women, natal women, who are not held in the female estate because they are deemed to be too dangerous to the other women in a women's prison. They'll be put in a secure unit in one of the men's prisons. So it's not the case that you can get a gender recognition certificate and tomorrow you'll be shipped off to, I can't think of a women's prison.
Holloway,
yes, that's the one I was trying to think of. Yes, I could picture the Holloway Road, but I couldn't get any further.
So one of the things you deal with is the history, and you take the history right back in one of your own essays. Mm. And you make the point that this is not a new phenomenon.
It's not. It's a part of being human. It's really surprising. I was amazed because it wasn't until the 1990s that my colleagues and I started uncovering this information, which was a revelation to us. It changed our understanding. When I was visiting that society in the 1970s, scared out of my wits and having no idea that, what it was that I was, that there was this history behind, the Bible. Despite the way in which it's usually quoted as being against transsexual people, its underpinnings in Judaic literature, in the Torah, for instance, that recognised that there are no fewer than seven genders because they saw life as it was. Similarly, anthropologists in visiting North America found all over North America separate tribes which very comfortably recognize that there are people living in, who don't fit this binary model of men being over there and women being over there and this enormous unbridgeable gap in between. In fact, the more you go around the world, and I've charted in the book, so I've tried to do a circuit of the globe and through history as well, that's the way we act in this Western Christian world is the anomaly. we're the people with the hang-up thinking that sex is perfectly binary, which is odd because everything else about humanity is so, you know, fuzzy. You know, we're not two heights. We're not nice or nasty. We're not clever or not so clever. You know, on every measure, we are brilliantly diverse. So why on earth do we think that there is a different rule that applies somehow magically to gender? In fact, even in that area, you know, the evidence of the fact that there are so many intersex people.
I was going to ask you about intersex, yeah. But that's a
separate thing. And it's a separate thing because of the separate way in which intersex people are dealt with.
Intersex means that you're born with both
male and female characteristics. That's a misunderstanding. Okay. I remember being taught that in my O-level biology textbooks. And there was a pretty picture of a hermaphrodite. And that is the level which we're having this debate in, you know, 14-year-old biology.
So what is intersex then?
Intersex is a class of conditions in which people are born with sexual characteristics which are somewhere on a spectrum between what's expected at one end and what's expected at the other. And what I mean by that is that if you are a man, then generally speaking, it's expected that all characteristics are in alignment. That is, you have a penis, so that's your external genitalia. You have testes, which have descended. Those are your internal gonads. That's the stuff that generates eggs or sperm. And then also that your secondary sexual characteristics are in line. Your body is producing the one dominant sex hormone. Although actually, having said that, you've actually got more testosterone going around inside you than I have.
Why is that?
Because I don't have ovaries, but your ovaries are producing testosterone as well as estrogen. And in fact, as you get older, the estrogen drops off with menopause and the testosterone keeps on pumping out, which is why we all get little tashes under our noses.
He says, feeling her top lip anxiously.
and trans women have electrolysis to remove hair from their faces. But that treatment wasn't devised for trans people. That's devised, you know, in the beauticians where I get my nails done every week, you know, there's a long procession of people with a variety of conditions, quite often to do with their ovaries, which are causing them to be fairly hirsute. And they had their hair removed, you know. So yeah, we have such a childlike understanding of gender in society because a lot of this is hidden. And what happens to intersex people, because they are born with, and there are something like 70 different intersex conditions that you can have. They're all quite rare, but if you add 70 quite rare conditions together, you actually end up with something that affects about 1% of the population. So that means that in an average street in Britain, which has got more than 100 houses, there's probably at least one intersex person on that street.
Oh, I always think it was 1% trans, but it's 1% intersex. No. So what is the percentage of trans
people?
We
don't know, except that the numbers seem to, with greater knowledge and with people feeling more prepared to come out, then the numbers go up. When I came out in the early 1970s, doctors were professing that 1 in 30,000 people were transsexual women like me, and something under 1 in 100,000 people were transsexual men. And if you do the sums on the population, on the adult population, that means that there would be about 280 transsexual men in the country. And, you know, I've seen more at the average party, to be honest. Mm. I've met more in my life. Over 4,000 people have applied for gender recognition certificates since they came into force in 2005. So those numbers were plainly wrong. And they were wrong simply because there was only one clinician in the whole of Britain who was dealing with transsexual people in the 1960s and 1970s. And
that was the appalling or not so appalling
John Randall.
John Randall, yes.
It's fascinating in the book, actually, that people have such differing views of him. But he had the power of life and death over us. You know, I remember being told about him, and that contributed to me being scared stiff. You know, what's going to, you know, what do I have to do? And what hoops do I need to jump through in order to? And the only other path seemed to be, if you read Jan Morris's book, you had to get on a plane to Casablanca. And I just didn't feel like the kind of exotic person who goes to Casablanca, certainly not in the 1970s. You know, we just about got Freddie Laker, you know, so we weren't going to go there.
Scrolling forward to the last few years, you have an essay by Stephanie Hirst, who's a sort of DJ, a radio DJ, very glamorous figure. Mm. And what she's saying is that the coming of social media has completely transformed it all over again.
It did. When I was an activist, I was involved in the campaign that brought about the gender recognition bill from 1992 to just after that happened in 2007. And during that time, when I first got started with that, we had practically no way of contacting anybody. We'd got a mailing list that had been built up by a society called the Beaumont Society, which was set up in the 1960s. But if you wanted to contact those people, then we had to print a newsletter and we had to fold it and stuff it in an envelope and we had to stick stamps on them. And we had practically no money, so we could hardly ever afford to write to people. And then the internet came along. I'm a computer scientist, so I was quite early into that in around about 1992, 93. And I was saying to my colleagues, look, this is magical because it's independent of distance and providing we can actually get people online. At that time, you could just about buy a PC, an Amstrad in PC world. People were starting to buy them. Modems are still quite exotic, but that all suddenly changed. But even then, and we built up nearly 1,000 people on our email mailing list, which meant that we were able to transform the way we did activism, because we could suddenly, at the drop of a hat, overnight, we could mobilise people to write to the Department for Education and Employment, for instance, who thought that they could get away with watering down our employment rights. And the next, within the next week, they received 300 letters independently written by people saying, this is what you're saying means to me. It was a complete broadside. It had never happened before. As a result of that, the new Labour government had to go away and write a policy on how to do consultation because they had had such a slap in the face from us. But even then, people were still very shy. We only took people out onto the streets twice because the consequences to so many people of being outed were too dire. People could still lose their jobs. I came back out. I'd been living in privately as a woman for many years when I joined Press for Change. And it was a really big dilemma to me at that time. You know, if you're going to have a political campaign, then you need to have visible representatives of it. But what are the consequences of that? Suddenly all your neighbours know that you're a transsexual woman. You know, they didn't. And I had quite lovely relationships with my neighbours on that basis, because that was quite a safe way to live among the muggles, as it were. And so we didn't ask people to come out, and they wouldn't have come out. We brought them out to say twice. We took them to 10 Downing Street to deliver a 10,000 signature paper petition in 1997. And we took them to the Royal Society of Medicine in 2002 to stand outside and wave papers. But that was the only time. But then, after the gender recognition bill, and I was fascinated to discover from my contributors in the book what they thought was going on here, that certainly, suddenly having the Gender Recognition Act on the books said something to a lot of people about their legitimacy as people, and that the government of the land had looked at trans people's issues and thought, this needs doing. And, you know, this is a legitimate thing. The fact that my colleagues and I were awarded an MBE and an OBE also said we were awarded those for doing something that was worth doing. So it's suddenly, you know, the message starting to come across to people.
And then in 2006, Facebook happened.
That's it.
Which, and, again, completely transformed.
And this caught me completely by surprise, because by that point I was being a bit like an old fogey. I was a bit dubious about getting involved in yet another piece of technology. But I saw people were getting on this. And the odd thing was that where previously they'd always written to us and said, is it safe to write to you? Is it safe to deal with you? You won't tell anybody, will you? But can you help me? And then suddenly people were popping up on Facebook and they were putting their blooming pictures online. And it suddenly became a virtuous circle, I think, that other people saw the same thing. Some people still hid behind nice pictorial avatars, but more and more people was, and I think, oh, that's what that person looks like. And I've been dealing with people. I never even asked people what their gender was when they wrote to me for help. They'd write to the address on the front of the website and say, my employer's done this, this and this. And I'd write back and say, well, look, I'm not a lawyer, but my friends are. And our advice to you is the following. And, you know, you can do this and you can and this is the law and they can't do that to you. And I realised that quite often I'd written to people and I'd never asked them how they identify, because it wasn't relevant to do so. Their problem was the same, whatever the label. So it was a transformation to see happening. And it coincided with the fact that as activists, we were absolutely worn out. We'd been doing this on top of our day jobs. As I said before, I was a jet-setting consultant for a very big IT services company. And in the evenings, no matter where I was in the world, I would go to my hotel room and I would get under the desk with a plug and a pair of crocodile clips. And I would jack my company laptop into the phone and get online and collect my emails and do activism in the evening before I went to bed. Because, I mean, when you're in a hotel and you're a woman, what else can you
do anyway?
So, you know, you couldn't go to the bar or anything else. So it worked very well. But it was by 2006, 2007, I was absolutely worn out. And so I was really keen to encourage a new generation. I could see all these young people coming up, and they'd come up without the baggage that I'd grown up with, because they'd hit teenage years at the time when it was a respectable thing to be trans, because the government had said it was respectable. And they were impatient and gobby, and they had a different way of doing things. And I knew that the time had come when I went on to one of the early blogging platforms called LiveJournal, and I saw somebody slagging me off. And I thought, okay, you know, we are now the problem. We're the old generation who are in the way. So I put out the message then very clearly, look, you know, it's your time. Please come along, knock us off our perches. We're happy to go. It's your turn. You can take this forward.
There are 22 essays in this. You've written a few of them. So there are, what, about 20 contributors? Or
there are 19. Well, there's 19 chapters of contributors. 19. One of the chapters has got three contributors, because I thought non-binary was such an interesting subject that I got as many experts into one chapter as possible.
How did you source all your contributors?
My address book, mainly, because I'm just extremely lucky in terms of the people I know. People from across the generations know me, and I seem to have managed to get to this age and still have my respect intact. And so I could say to people, look, I'm going to write this book. It's really exciting. Here's the idea. Would you like to take part? I actually had one person on Facebook. She's chapter one. She actually came to me quite angrily and said, well, I suppose you wouldn't have me in your book. And I said, oh, tell me your story. And she told me this story of, she was born in 1943, I think it was. So she's in her 70s. And she had this amazing story of what it was like to not be one of these famous 1950s transsexual women, just being an ordinary person who was struggling to get some sense from a doctor. And it took her about 20 years to get to where she wanted to be. And that marked for me, that's our starting point.
That was such a touching piece, yes.
That's how life was. It's what I would have faced if I'd been slightly older in the 1960s than 12 years old, kneeling on the carpet in the kitchen. When I wrote my previous books, which were parts history and parts personal autobiography, I decided that I would start my story when I was already me. And it was about the story about living through making these changes happen. So that's that's having a life post all the business of transition, and it's been such a fantastic life. You know, some people have sometimes asked me, you know, would you rather not have been trans, or would you rather have been born a woman to begin with? Well, a bit of me would say, yeah, that would actually be easy. But actually, I look back and think I would probably have been unutterably trivial and self-obsessed. And I am so grateful that life gave me this punch and actually held me to look at this big social issue, which is one of the biggest unresolved social issues of the current time still. And that I actually had a chance to make a difference. And I'm so proud of that. And I'm so, so if I'm going to come back again, I want to do that again.
Christine Burns there. Trans Britain, Our Journey from the Shadows is published by Unbound and is out now. And if you want further reading on this very complex subject, I can recommend the extensive and enlightening reading list in the back of the book, which includes many of the most up-to-date thinkers on trans politics and culture, and surprisingly, a few old antagonists too.
Next week, philosopher Timothy Morton joins us to discuss his radical ideas about humanity's relationship with the environment, with his challenging and brilliant new book, Being Ecological.
Meanwhile, there are thousands of podcasts in the Guardian archive on politics, science, technology, global development and more. You can find them all at theguardian.com/podcasts. But for now, from me, Claire Armistead.
Me, Sian Kane.
And our producer, Susanna Trezilian. Goodbye and thanks for listening.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.